accession number 20525, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Ken Ellis, a former Lancaster pilot, recorded by Rodney Giesler on the 4th of July, 2000, for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Okay, Ken, when were you born, your date of birth?
27 August 22.
Mm-hmm. And where did you come from? Where did you grow up?
Derby. Mm-hmm.
What was your father doing there? Is
he... he was an accountant. Mm-hmm.
And so in 1922, you would have been 18 when the war started, is that right? That's my...
No, the war started in
17
when the war started, yes.
And did you wait for your call-up, or did you volunteer?
Oh, no, we all went along.
Periodically.
Well, I was fascinated, from my point of view, there was where the Nissan factory, I think it's a Nissan factory, just outside Derby, Burniston.
The Toyota one, yeah.
Oh, it's Toyota, is it? Yes, they started a flying school there, a civil flying school, and with magisters, and because I used to spend an awful lot of time around there, and I used to watch these little aeroplanes coming in and landing, and I think, oh, that's good, that is, I'll have a go at that. And so that really turned me on to flying. So you
went along and volunteered as soon as you could.
Yes.
But presumably you were too young at that age, were you, or what? Were you sent home, or what was the procedure then?
Oh no, we went along and we had a medical and a quick interview, and then we were accepted, but. We still had to go to the aircrew selection, and I went down to a place at Birmingham. We had the early forms of intelligence tests, an old-fashioned gramophone, and the base plate had holes in it, spiral holes, and through spiral holes going round, and you had a pointer attached to a wire, and you had to follow these round and catch them as they went round. And if you got in the hole, of course, it connected a circuit, and so they recorded how your manipulation and so on, how your brain was working with manipulation. So then they decided whether you were okay for aircrew, and they decided whether you should go on pilot training or navigator training at that stage. And so I was accepted as a pilot, or pilot navigator was the selection, but I was put on the pilot course then. And then we had to wait until they called us.
What were the deciding factors to whether you were sent for pilot or navigator training?
I've no idea. Mm. I can guess, but I've no idea. I mean, knowing the kind of people who were navigators, an awful lot of school teachers and that sort of person. Whereas the pilots, there were quite a lot of policemen and active people. They judge your personality, I suppose, these tests.
And temperament, I suppose.
And temperament and mm-hmm. so on, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but when you went on the pilot training, if you failed it, they put you on a navigator's course, or later a bomb aimer's course, because they want to bomb aimers very quickly, which is an abbreviated course.
Anyhow, you were selected for pilot training, and where did you go on from there?
Went down to what's the name? Newquay, to initial training wing. First of all, we went to Lord's in London, and we were issued with all our kit and processed inoculations, all that sort of thing. And then I went down to Newquay. And we did our initial training there, which was a very good brush up. We had a marvellous mathematics and physics teacher. He was absolutely super, and he started right at basics with algebra and all the basic processes of arithmetic, and brushed up our mental arithmetic and so on. It was very, very good. And we did all the elementary stuff there. Lots of physical training, very elementary drill. We used to go on parade with the warrant officer, and of course we weren't very keen on drill, and obviously we showed it, and he'd say, "Wake up! Wake up! Mm-hmm. Cream of Britain's manhood, and look at you!" And some of them back say, "Yes, the Queen's gone sour through being messed around."
But, so at this stage it was entirely classroom work, was it?
Basically classroom work, mm-hmm. Yes, and fitness.
Yeah. When did they let you loose on an aeroplane?
Well, I didn't. Some of the chaps went through a grading school, but I didn't. I went straight over to the States. And the first aeroplane I flew was a Stearman at a primary flying school. And we did get my mathematics right. We had three stages. We had the primary, basic, and the secondary. And I think it was 60 hours and then two lots of 70. That's right, 200 hours we had. And
whereabouts in the States was this?
Down in Georgia. I went to a place called Americus, which is Jimmy Carter country, peanut country, and it was a civil flying school, but we had one RAF officer there and one US Army Air Corps officer, Major Baldwin, who was called the washing machine, because anybody who was failed was failed by him. If the instructor didn't think much of you, the chief civilian instructor took you up. And if
they were all
civilian
instructors, were they?
Oh, yes, all civilians.
American
yes.
civilians.
All American civilians, yes.
And what sort of discipline regime did you live under there? I mean, RAF or what?
Oh, no. The first school we went to was all British cadets, but after that we were mixed up. And, it was as few as, say, a quarter British and all the rest Americans. But, oh, no, they treated us just the same as they do, with all this hazing and all that sort of thing. I mean, if you were a naughty boy in the Air Force, you had to go to the cookhouse and do some scrubbing or peeling potatoes or something like that. But there, they treated you as an officer cadet. And so they used to inspect your quarters and every day, and you were, anything you did wasn't quite up to standard, you were given demerits, and you were allowed 6 demerits in the week, and anything over, you had to walk a tour, and that meant you had to do it on your day off, and you could only walk 8 in a day, and walking a tour was to march at attention up and down outside the cadet headquarters for 50 minutes with 10 minutes just easy, and it was quite amusing. And on my course, there were chaps who'd remustered from the Army and the Air Force, and they didn't think much of that at all. It was very much against their dignity, but for me, straight out of school, it didn't matter, did it? It was all great fun, and I must confess, I thoroughly enjoyed my time over there.
Now, all the American students, they were all Army Air Corps.
Oh yes, they were
personnel in uniform.
They were in the U.S. Army Air Corps, as it was then. You see, later it became the U.S. Air Force, but at that time it was U.S. Army Air Corps.
What about? I mean, you mentioned there was an RAF officer there, was there?
Oh yes.
And any NCOs to keep?
No. They appointed NCO sergeants and NCO lieutenants from the cadets for the discipline. And they were
sort of prefect system then.
Yeah. The kind of chaps who were selected were mainly public school boys who'd been in the cadet corps.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, because I went to a grammar school. We had no such thing. I was in the scouts. But no, they were those sort of chaps. And it worked very well, actually. Worked very well because they were our friends, but they had to keep discipline, and we accepted it. Except for the old sweats who'd remustered, and strange to relate, most of those old sweats failed and went back to the Army.
When you said they'd remustered, were they previous air crew? Or the Army old sweats, were they?
Yes, Army. No, yeah. No.
You mentioned there were some RAF old sweats as well.
That's right. Fitters and corporals and even sergeants, we had one. Yeah. They were permitted to apply for air crew. It's the only thing they could go apart from their own trade was into air crew. And the same with the police. We had lots of policemen, And the only thing they could go into was as air crew. They couldn't volunteer for anything else. So we had quite a few policemen.
Anyhow, you mentioned you did about 200 hours on Stearman's.
No, I did 70 on Stearman's, then went on to a thing called the Vultee BT-13, and... I did 60 hours on Stearman's, then 70 on BT-13s, which was a thing like a Harvard with a fixed undercarriage, and fairly hot ship. But and then we did 70 hours. I went to a twin-engine training school, but some of them went on to Harvard training schools with the intention of going on fighters. But it didn't make a lot of difference when we came back to the Air Force. But I went on the twin engine, and we had three different aircraft that we flew, and Harvard as well. We used to use the Harvard for instrument flying. But it was a marvellous training course.
What were the twin engine types you trained on?
Well, there was a Beechcraft AT-10, there was a Curtiss AT-9, and there was a Cessna Crane, which was an AT, I think it was a 13 or something like that.
So it's really to give you what in civilian life was a twin engine rating.
That's right, yes, get you used to it.
The Stearman was a lot pokier than the Tiger Moth, wasn't it?
Oh no, it was a very sturdy aeroplane.
Yeah. Did you ever fly Tiger Moth?
No, I didn't. No, I never.
So you went straight onto a Stearman and soloed on it and everything.
Yeah, I didn't. I did the odd flight later on both the Tiger Moth and the monoplane, I can't remember the name of it now.
Magister.
But that was when I was, on the squadron and so on. We used to borrow it just to go around. But I was essentially trained on the Stearman, which was a very sturdy aeroplane. It's a metal aeroplane with a 220 horsepower engine and a very basic. I mean, for instance, the instrumentation was only an altimeter and the RPM gauge. And we didn't have an airspeed indicator.
No airspeed indicator?
No, and you had a turn and bank, that's all.
Really? No VSI, no vertical speed indicator?
No, it was just essentially, they said they were training us to fly by the seat of our pants. And so they taught us speed was the whistle in through the wires, and approaching was a mixture of the whistle between in the wires and the angle that you were descending. And it was very effective. We used to do aerobatics too on that basis. You know, you'd put the nose down until you got a certain noise, and then you pull it up and go over the top or what have you. It's very effective.
And I mean, there was a relationship between airspeed and RPM, wasn't there, that you could go by or not necessarily?
Well, obviously the RPM went up if you kept the same power, but you weren't really looking at that. You were listening, It was all by the seat of your pants. It was very, very effective. Of course, quite impractical when you were flying a heavy bomber and so on, but it certainly sharpened you up, and I thought it was very effective.
Was there much accidental stalling or not on the course? People...
Not at that time, no, because that was one of the first things they taught you, was how all about stalling and spins and so on.
Yeah.
And they used to do, one of the favourite things was a Chandel, which was a relic of the First World War. It was used by First World War pilots, where you'd put the nose down in a certain direction. When you got a certain speed, you'd start climbing and go into a bank and around. And the what we did was where you ended up in the opposite direction. And that was very good training, really, for control of the aeroplane.
That's the first time I've heard it, because, I mean, when I learned to fly, the constant iteration from the instructor in the back was, what's your airspeed?
Yeah, that's right.
And you had to do 60 knots on the approach.
Well, of course, that was only on the Stearman. That was teaching you to handle the aeroplane. Once we got on the BT, then it was different. We were taught instrument flying and cross-country flying and formation flying and that sort of thing. It was a different emphasis. And then, of course, when we got on the twins, of course, then it was those things, but rather more practice and engine failures and all that sort of thing. I thought the American training was excellent. The only thing was, of course, they didn't have much navigation training, but the theoretical training was excellent. We had specialist engine instructors and so on, and theory of flight instructors, and we had some marvellous manuals. And we were, of course, the Americans, Americans don't believe in written examinations per se like we do. It's all question and answer, or true or false, and they get through an awful lot of very searching questions in a short time. So when we were given an exercise and told to swat up some things in the book, or we were given an exercise on work we'd done in class, they'd give us this paper and you'd go through it like a dose of salts, and it was very effective. He certainly remembered it anyway. And
You were saying just now that navigation wasn't a strong point on the course.
No.
I mean, was that to do with the fact that you had very good flying weather most of the time, or what?
Well, when I say navigation, the pilot navigation was all important. Mm. Being able to find your destination, map read, and do calculations in your head and so on. But in the Air Force, pilots did basic navigation plotting exercises and so on, so they knew all about what the navigator was doing, whereas the Americans, they believed in formation flying, so they certainly had navigators, but very few, so you get a whole unit which would have one navigator, maybe a standby navigator, one navigator, and they'd all form eight on him, and he'd get them there,
you
see.
Had to get it right.
Yeah, and that's why we had a thing called Darkey Darkey.
Yeah.
In England, I can't remember the frequency now, but VHF frequency. And if you were lost, you could call up Darkey Darkey and they would direct you to the nearest airfield. Well, of course, nobody ever used it. I mean, you were in disgrace if you used it. But once the Americans came, it was Darkey Darkey. Darkey Darkey, where am I?
How much instrument flying did you do there then?
Well, quite a lot. Yeah. I can't remember now, but it was quite a lot.
Was it, or?
I can't even remember that now.
I mean, if you had perfect flying conditions half the time, you didn't need instruments, did you?
Oh, no, obviously you had to learn. Yes, we had.
You found a cloud and flew into it, didn't you?
I think we had a hood, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when we were flying later, civil flying, we used to have a little screen that would just block you out so much, you see, obviously, so that the check pilot or the instructor could see over the top. But I think there we used to have a hood right over us, if I remember right. Yeah. Oh, no, we did. The instrument flying training was excellent, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Yes, it was really good.
How did you get on with your American colleagues, the other cadets? I mean, did you
marvellous. Oh, yes. Of course, it was only the initial training school where we were all British. But once we got to the other schools, we were mixed up. And, for instance, I mean, I shared a room with a couple of Americans, and one was a Coptown Hensley, who was the son of a poor tobacco farmer who had won a basketball scholarship to the university, and the other one, poor chap, was the son of a Methodist minister in New Hampshire, and he killed himself, unfortunately, while we were there. Very sad, really.
Flying accident.
Yes, yes, on takeoff. Mm. But we were great friends. When I say great friends, There was no difference between friendship between the British and the Americans. We were very great friends. In fact, we were amused. You know how if you get a group of Englishmen, Irishmen and Scotland together, they're always fighting the civil wars. Well, the Americans were still fighting the civil war, and we kept out of it. We were so amused. They were absolutely ruthless and absolutely amazing.
The American Civil War, yeah.
Yeah, American Civil War. I mean, in good fun, of course, but they used to really tear into one another. Oh, no, there was no problem at all.
What about disparity in money? Because you were on different pay schemes, weren't you?
Well, we didn't get very much time off. We used to have one day off in eight, you see, and we had to... We finished at 8 o'clock one night, and we had to be back on parade at 8 o'clock the following night, and you had the choice, either you got a bus into town and spent the night there, or you just went around the next day. But so there wasn't a lot to spend money on, and the Americans were incredibly generous. There were schemes where to entertain the British cadets, as they used to call them down there. They were incredibly generous, and So money, no, it was never a problem at all. We just didn't, I never thought about it.
The what only about female was, company? Was there much of that around or not?
Well, some chaps found it, of course we were a bit gauche, weren't we, at my age.
All off the basis.
But some of the others, they found it, and oh yes, and they'd be, instead of going off in the bus, they'd have a big white Buick pick them up from the station and take them off. One or two chaps, but you know, quite frankly, it was 100%, you know, a job, really. We were on the whole time. I mean, unlike these people that go around football vandals and so on, we didn't have time for that. We were working so hard all the time. Structured, you know, but it was... And also, we enjoyed it, too. Yes, it was a terrible thing when people were washed off the course and had to go back, because it was very stimulating, indeed.
Also, you ate well, didn't you? I mean, away from...
Fantastic. Fantastic. I remember how at ITW at Newquay having half-cooked herrings, you know, still red inside. Well, when we arrived down in Georgia, Albany was the first place, and went to into the dining room. Of course, they had the senior classman and the junior classman system. So if you were 2 months, say, in a base, the first period, you'd be the junior classman, and it's rather like fagging in a public school. And the senior classman used to bully you, you see, and then you became the senior classman, which really irritated the army people who'd come in. But when you went into the dining room, you had to sit on the first 2 inches of your chair, absolutely bolt upright, looking straight ahead, and the senior classman would go around and check upon you, and then he'd say, I forget the word he used, I think relax or something like that. The table was full of plates of T-bone steaks and grape juice and various juices and fantastic food, pineapples, peaches. Well, you can imagine, from wartime England arriving to this sort of thing, they didn't know the war was on there.
But is this sitting on the edge of your seat and so on, I mean, was this the American idea or what? So,
oh yes, that's right. We were completely... the system was completely American,
yeah.
Absolutely, yes. But it was their idea of training and discipline and so on.
So apart from sitting upright and so on, I mean, you didn't have to eat by numbers or anything, did you?
Oh, if you were a naughty boy, you would have to. Yes, if you were a naughty boy, you had to eat by numbers, that's right, it did. But, I mean, not many people did that, it wasn't that, but they had to really be naughty to do that.
Because, I mean, this sitting on the edge of your seat and so on, the impression I've got up to now is it was all pretty laid back.
Oh yes, well that was only when you first got there,
oh,
you
see.
But once you'd you got down, you could wriggle and so on. That was all right.
Yeah.
But it was just the
as you
part
moved
of the
up
system.
To stop you being too cocky, I suppose, or was that it? Or
well, I mean, for instance, if you general discipline was covered by the demerit system, flying discipline. Supposing you did something awful when you were flying. They had the system that you had a big dumbbell, a big yellow dumbbell, which you hung around your neck with a notice on saying, I am a dumbbell. I tried to land with my gear up or something like that. And you had
called the pilot officer prune thing that you used to
leave. Absolutely, that's their idea of it, yes. Yeah. And of course, everywhere you went, you marched around the station, and you can imagine marching up through all the other ranks there and with this notice on, it was really very demeaning, but it was, I suppose, better than being washed off. They gave you a chance, you see.
Yeah.
No, it's all very good. I thought it was excellent, quite frankly. The only thing, and of course, the fact that we didn't get very much time off, we accepted it. Yeah. Never thought about it at all.
You were saying that the sort of prefect system you tended to have ex-public schoolboys. Controlling discipline.
As the cadet officers, yes.
As the cadet officers. I mean, did the Americans come under these guys as well, or did they have their own line of command?
Oh, well, when we got in with the Americans, they're nearly all Americans. But at that time we were talking about the primary flying school, where we were on steermans, yes.
They were nearly all Brits. Then.
Well, we were all
Brits. All Brits.
All the cadets.
Oh, I see. It's only when you went on to twin flying that you went on to... You have Americans mixing with you.
Oh, no, only at primary school we were all British. Mm. Once we left primary school and went on to the second and the third stage, we were mixed with the Americans.
Mm-hmm. And that was... Well, yeah, you only had Stearman's at primary school, did
That's
you?
That's right.
And then you went on to the Harvard and the other twins.
Went on to the Volte BT 13,
yeah.
Basic, and then the others at the advanced flying school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long did you spend in the States then?
About a year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then back to Britain on a boat, was it? Or?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Came back on the QE2.
Well,
the QE1, yes.
Yeah.
Came back. There weren't a lot of us. There were mainly American troops and American nurses and so on. And
what year would this be? About 43?
About 43, yes. Mm. Yes. Early 43. Yeah.
And you were... The QE one
late 42,
about 20,000 passengers at a time, didn't it?
Haven't a clue.
And you were pretty crowded, were you?
Well, yes, very much so. And when we got in, we got into Gourock, and of course they disembarked all the Americans first, and we were kept on. So we had the run of the ship, and I even went up the tower. One of the funnels was a false funnel. And up the top was a platform. I remember that very well.
I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long did you have to spend on her then? I mean, you disembarked at Gourock as well, did you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I can't remember now, but it was 4 or 5 days. 4 days, I think.
Yeah. So you were back, what were you by this time, a sergeant pilot?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And you had your wings up and everything?
Oh, wait a minute. I can't remember when we were made sergeant pilot. Oh, yes, so we were made sergeant pilots when we got our wings up, that's right. We were first of all AC2s, then that was at initial training wing in Newquay, and then when we went over there we were LACs, but we wore American uniform.
Oh.
As soon as we got down there, we were issued with all this, you can imagine, Tiger Moth style flying gear and flying boots and so on, but once we got over there, that was all in kit bags, and it was all put into store. And we were issued an American uniform, brown shoes and khaki drill and so on.
American cap badges as well.
The only thing we kept was our RAF hat, uh-huh. Cap, you know, forage cap.
Yeah.
With a white flash on it.
Yeah.
All the rest of it was American. Very good quality too. Mm. I mean, you probably don't remember, the issue underwear to the troops was very thick, heavy woolen stuff. Very, very good for trench warfare and that sort of thing, but for us it was a bit silly. But Americans were very, very excellent quality underwear and shirts and so on. Yeah, a very good laundry system too, and very keen. You had to really keep yourself up that way, but you could do it, you see. Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting.
So you've arrived back in the UK, landed at Gourock on the Clyde.
Oh, interestingly,
yeah.
When I was at advanced flying school, there was a great friend of mine was a lieutenant in one of the cavalry regiments, and he was the equivalent of the territorials,
National Guard,
and we were crewed up together, and we always two of us flew. When we flew solo, one would fly the aeroplane and the other would act as the co-pilot, and he'd switch over, you see. We flew together, and he had his wife there, and Doughty, his name was, and he was a marvellous character. And you see, we were all treated as cadets, or cadets they used to call them there. It's completely different to the Air Force and to the Royal Air Force. And when we came back, of course, we were all made sergeant pilots. One or two were kept back over there to be flying instructors. One or two. But it was amusing because when we were drawing to the end of our training course, the Americans pushed round a form asking us what we wanted to go on, whether, you know, fighters or bombers and so on. And to everybody, the British and the Americans. And to a man, the British said they wanted to come back home and be on operations. And almost to a man, the Americans said they wanted to go on transport command or instruction. And Of course, we didn't know anything about this till later, but we did know that we were given a special day off. The RAF were given a day off and a special bus to take them into town. And the Americans were herded into a room, and the CO really gave them a lashing down, and he said, you know, the British have done this and you've done that. Of course, the fact was they wanted to stay with their families in England. We wanted to get back home to our families.
In America, they wanted to stay.
Yes, the Americans wanted to stay with in America with their families, and we wanted to all get back home again. And that was quite amusing, really.